Good morning. You are listening to Conversations on WDRT Community Radio 91.9, coming to you from Viroqua, Wisconsin. You can also live stream this program on WDRT.org. The programs are available as podcasts in the Conversations archives on WDRT.org in case you can't stay on for the full hour or you want to send that link to somebody else. Many things. Anyway, I'm Mary Christensen, hosting this morning's program with my guest, Philothea Beeson.
Hi, Mary.
I'm so happy to have you here. You're one of the first people who came to visit me when we moved here. Exactly. Well, we visited this weekend, 30 years ago. We found our property, bought it. The last thing we did as we were leaving town, we thought we weren't going to find anything. And we moved back in June. And you drove up the driveway one day. I thought, who's coming up here? And she got out of the car and said, hi, neighbor. I'm bringing you some berries. Oh, it was so sweet. It really was important to me that somebody came to visit because my husband, Steve, is a builder, and he needed work right away. So he had promised my sister up in Minneapolis that he'd come up there and build out her kitchen. So I was really alone, kind of like dropped off there with a six-year-old and alone. Anyway, and so many people weren't out and about in the summer, right? It's not the Viroqua that it is now, back then. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so Philothea, lately I've been being asked by other people who've moved here about our history.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can only go back to 1993, and then I work at Pleasant Ridge Waldorf School, so I met a lot of the people who started the school 13 years earlier, so my history could go back there, but it doesn't go back really that much further. And so I pulled out a copy of the Kickapoo Pearls as a way to introduce this person. I said, here is a really interesting and really vital history, because I loved reading that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then your name is in there too, along mm-hmm. with a lot of other friends that I know. But I thought maybe you could tell us a little bit about that time period. Like the mm-hmm. 70s, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
I think that's when that was produced. And I think that's when some of the people started coming here for whatever, and that's what I want you to tell us, all the different things.
Okay. Well, I can really go on and on about this. I can mm-hmm. hardly believe I've been here over 50 years. Am I that old?
Wow.
But we moved here in 1970, and we came because we were kind of, you know, influenced by the Back to the Land movement. I still have my copy, number one, issue number one of the Mother Earth News. And that introduced me to, you know, a lot of thinking about organic farming, concern about chemicals and things like that. We were already talking about this in 1970. And I was living in Connecticut, and another couple and my husband and I decided to run away and buy land. We just started looking all over the United States in United Country Realty catalogs and said, well, what about Wisconsin? And the land was cheap and the water was good and there wasn't much population, and it just seemed like we should check it out. And my friend had gone to, his grandparents had lived in Mount Horeb or something like that. So he remembered childhood coming up to Wisconsin and coming to the farm and everything. And he was coming back to go to the UW in Madison. So it kind of made sense to check out Wisconsin. So we actually sold our house, packed everything up into a U-Haul truck, and drove to Wisconsin without ever having ever been in the state. My parents were wringing their hands, and I think I made them wring their hands about a lot of things I did. Because we came out here, we built our own house. We bought 80 acres for $8,000.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And we built our own house, and all we had built before that was a rabbit hutch. So we didn't know anything about building. We poured our cement on the hottest day of the year. We had a whole bunch of lumps and bumps in that slab for the rest of our lives. And I have a picture of us standing on our ladders, putting up the stud walls, the first three stud walls. Anyway, we had to rebuild that house several times, put new siding on, change the windows. We've changed the windows many times. Anyway, and once we got out here, we met other people who were finding this area. We didn't come here knowing anybody. We came to the Driftless area. No one called it the Driftless at that time. It's kind of a geological name, and we called it the Okooch Mountains. Well, the local people didn't even call it the Okooch Mountains. I guess we called it the Kickapoo Valley or the Coulee region. But we just loved the names. Coon Valley, Romance. I mean, we were just in love with this place, and it was so beautiful. So we bought vacant land, and then we built a house. And then we tried to figure out, how are we going to make a living out here? What was happening is that there wasn't really a very good way of making a living out here. Maybe the hospital, the courthouse, and the nursing home, and the feed mill. And otherwise, there wasn't a lot of way to make a living. And a lot of young people were actually leaving farms and going to the cities to work in automobile factories. Mm-hmm. And what are they? Janesville and Beloit and... Mm-hmm. And so that's why a lot of farms were really, I mean, there was abandoned farms. We looked at a lot of abandoned houses and thought, maybe we're better off just buying vacant land and building something. And so, yeah, I think the first thing we did to make money was work in tobacco.
That's what I was thinking. I mean, it's very interesting to think about people coming from cities and other places and not even being farmers, right? But
no.
Wanting to have that lifestyle.
Exactly.
But here, at least, there was this economy through the tobacco or through the apples.
Right.
So things like that.
Almost everybody that came out picked mm-hmm. apples. That was pretty good cash.
So just people were getting involved in the cycle of the year, the mm-hmm. real attachment to the earth, which is what was drawing them, in a way.
Right, but I was really very naive in a lot of ways. I mean, I grew up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., and we had a little teeny garden, maybe two tomato plants. I mean, I really knew nothing about gardening. I didn't even know what part of the broccoli you ate. My mother always served stuff in square frozen packages. You know, she boiled up the vegetables. I didn't know what they looked like growing in the garden. I was very naive, but I had childhood memories of visiting relatives on farms and out in Illinois and stuff. And all these memories would just stick with me, the collie dog and the big front porch, rabbits in the pen. I got a song that Kate Walter and I used to sing about that. And, you know, tire swing and, you know, just some, you know, one afternoon and in my childhood. We just plant these seeds. I want to live in the country. And I want to grow my own food, and I like to learn how to eat wild plants, but I didn't know anything. I think my first book was how to, you know, stalking the wild asparagus and, you know, learning to identify some plants that you can eat and things like that. But I was really a beginner in a lot of ways.
So how did you hook up with other people who were, I mean, were there other people coming in 1970?
There were, and we were kind of few and far between, and we'd say, well, there are other people here. It was how derogatory that is. But we met people from the outside. And this was a pretty rural area and pretty protected. People went to rural schools and then usually came back here. And it was, and so we were really obviously transplants. Mm-hmm. But almost all of us can tell a story that of a neighbor, especially out in the rural areas, that was really glad to have someone come out here, buy some land, build a house, or fix up an old barn or an old house. And so we had wonderful neighbors, and they put up with all our ignorance and naivete, and they brought us, you know, they brought us food, and when we went down to visit them, they always took us to their garden at the end of the visit and, you know, picked a bunch of things and sent us home with a big bag of, you know, produce. And so we had a very good experience with that. My husband also got involved in the farm organization. What was it? NFO, mm-hmm. National? Mm-hmm. So he made friends with farmers, and he was... I had actually went from one marriage to another, but my second husband had come out here to milk cows. And he also had this naive view of farming. He had gone up to Minnesota to stay with his grandparents in the summer. And to him, farming was petting kitties, mm-hmm. riding the pony, gathering blueberries, you know, pulling up the water in a bucket out of a well, an artesian well. And so he decided he wanted to farm, and when he came out, and he was farming with cows and milking cows, he said, I just had no idea the stress and strain and hard work that it was and all the machinery that breaks down and everything. So it was, he had also very idealistic, view of coming out to the country and farming.
Yeah, I remember the first time I found out that Mike and Sherry... were dairy farming and didn't know anything about it. And
we really just needed our neighbors. We mm-hmm. really, really did. But we would find each other. Mm-hmm. We would find each other. And I know Sherry and her group of friends up there by Brush Hollow, the girls, they were having babies, and they had a little quilting group, and they got together once a week, brought their kids, and they were quilting in an old church and near Avalanche, and it was just like we were trying to recreate actually an old way of living. We didn't know much about it, but we wanted to do it, and we wanted the information from the people who lived here, mm-hmm. and that is partly about the Kickapoo Pearls. Mm-hmm. Some of my very early friends here, I'm thinking it was in the 70s. Yes, it was. Must have been in the 70s. There was some kind of government writers' project, mm-hmm. and they funded it. And Mike Wright, I know, definitely was part of that writers' project. Maybe Kate Walter was, too, because Kate was involved in the newspaper, right, and worked up at the Epitaph in Lafarge for a while. And the Kickapoo Pearls was a project to go interview people in the area, mostly who were already in nursing homes, mm-hmm. really to go back a few decades and find out what it was like even earlier right. than us. And I used the Kickapoo Pearls as a history resource in the school when I taught elementary school. It was a wonderful resource. And then the children who were in their, you know, third or fourth grade, they wanted to go interview people. So now you're interviewing me, and I'm one of the older people. I'm not in the nursing home yet. But I, you know, you see you have a history. It's a living history.
Mm-hmm. It is. And this is exactly what my interest is that when I started this program, mm-hmm. I was wanting to capture what happened here in downtown Viroqua to make it this vibrant, thriving mm-hmm. town that people come to and just feel like it's so cool, but they have no idea that 30 years ago, it was very vacant and not what it is. And the farmer's market consisted of two vans with two farmers. And, you know, I just wanted to build up an archive, really, of these stories so that we have it. Mm-hmm. You know? It's like an on-air Kickapoo
right.
Pearls. But,
well, Viroqua went through several different changes while we were here. I mean, we would see Main Street Viroqua in 1940, and then Main Street Viroqua in 1960, and then 1980. And, you know, we always would say, turn left where the old such and such used to be. The old Lutheran church, the old dairy. The dairy isn't there anymore.
Right.
That's where the bank is, Citizens First. That was a dairy, and a lot of people hung out there. You could get ice cream that was made from local mm-hmm. cream. And across from that was a church. It's still there. That was the old Emmanuel Lutheran Church. And that's where I got my first job. I mean, we realized we got to have some cash coming in. I mean, there was apple picking and there was tobacco. And... So we picked the tobacco in the fall, and then I guess I think I got a job in a little store on Main Street, which is called So and So, S-E-W, and it was a little shop with fabric and sewing machines. Mm-hmm. And but that was one night a week, so that wasn't enough to keep the body alive. So then there was an advertisement for a daycare center that was opening, and they wanted a director, cook, and aide. And I applied for all three. Well, my training was in French and in education, so I had a degree in education, but it was secondary education. I hadn't really done anything with little children except been a babysitter. But I applied, and they said, well, here's an old church. You can have the basement. You have the backyard. You decorate it. You paint it. You furnish it. You hire the staff. You decide the food program, the educational program. Get some training in administration. Take some early childhood courses. And
and the job, all of them are yours.
And I'm the only one that said, I think that would be fun. So they hired me. And really, that was a wonderful job. And I love the idea of starting with a blank slate. You're free to make this happen. And I didn't know that I had that skill, but I mean, I have done that in several events and, yeah, you know, founding things. But anyway, the daycare center went for about 8 years under my direction. And we moved from the Emanuel Lutheran Church, we moved over to the County Teachers College and the Normal School, which is now the Historical Society and Museum there, Vernon County, and that by the hospital. And we were in there for a number of years. A beautiful building. Those were two beautiful buildings. One was the Normal School and one was the elementary school. Mm-hmm. And they were built in the same era, and they had these terrazzo floors and, you know, marble in the bathrooms. And they're really beautiful buildings in their time. And so we were there, and then eventually the daycare center bought their own building, and it's now on West Decker on the way to the high school. Mm-hmm. Has a little picket fence around it. And so I worked there till... some of the parents were saying, you know, we like you as a teacher. Is there any way you can take the kids out of daycare and
into first, second?
Into first, second, yeah, and third. And the daycare center board was not interested in starting a school. So I said, well, I could just help the parents find some kind of school model or something, and we could figure out how to start a school. But I didn't think I could be the teacher.
And at that time, like by that time, 10 years or so had elapsed, or nine or whatever, and more people were coming. And
more
the people who were living up and down the valley were having their children.
Right. That was the time. Yeah, so more and more people were coming, and I would say the Gaze Mills was one center, because that was near the apple orchards. And I think, you know, boy, I mean, the land down there was really cheap. Of course, we probably figured out later on that most everything there had been flooded once. And that's why the houses were so affordable. But there was another center of activity in Richland Center. And both of those groups came to the conclusion that there just wasn't enough food out here. I mean, here we are out in the country, but you go to the grocery store and they have potatoes, cabbage,
carrots, maybe
stuff that, you know, would keep in a root cellar or something, like very little produce. And I knew people who moved out here and moved away because they just couldn't get groceries here. I mean, they're just not enough. If you were a vegetarian or something, there's just no variety. And so both of those groups, and there was a group up in Bloom City too, where we had food buying clubs. So we'd get together and decide that we wanted to order stuff in bulk. And still, it wasn't produce all that much. But there was a real interest in grains, getting whole grains, getting a grinder. Everybody I knew had a grain grinder on their counter. And so we wanted to buy food in bulk and then, you know, divvy it up and share it. And that was the beginning of these food co-ops.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, let's just take a little break here. You're listening to the Conversations program My name is Mary Christensen. My guest is Philothea Beeson. We're at WDRT 91.9, and you can stream this program at WDRT.org or listen to the archive program later. Okay, let's get back. You know, that last beginning of the buying clubs and the co-ops,
yes,
that was happening across the nation. That was the beginning of the starting the food co-ops, too, because that's what I was involved with. And in the 70s, wherever I moved, that was really starting.
Right.
So I was curious, it was Mother Earth News that you were reading. What were there other things that people were picking up on? I mean,
Okay, I was thinking, who wrote all the organic stuff? The really very early...
The organic magazine.
I'll dream it up in a while. But, you know, the Nearing family was very influential. Almost all of us had read about the Nearings.
Right.
Then I got a book called Flight from the City. People were leaving New York City. Rents were going up high. They were finding they could find a farm for, you know, $10,000-$15,000, and they'd be rent free. And some people made their own clothes and, you know, just did everything themselves. There was so much interest in self-sufficiency. Just
like now, there's that resurgence.
Right. I hope so. I hope so. Well, I certainly see it here in Viroqua.
Right.
It's very encouraging to see young people moving here and wanting to farm and wanting to grow produce and wanting to grow organically and raise their kids in a really healthy environment. Mm-hmm. And so that's, well, that's kind of what brought you here. I'm thinking, Mary, why did you come here?
Yeah, same thing. I mean, the economy around the cities was getting insane. We were in California, but I had been raised in Minnesota, and I felt comfortable in a rural area. I really knew I could do it, especially by that time in my life, because I'd making the break. You know, I'd gone away. I'd done many, many, many things, traveled a lot, and so I was ready, really, to have the kind of roots that one really needs to establish if you want to do
roots.
It, right?
Yes,
yeah, roots was really important.
So you came because you knew there was a Waldorf school here.
That's right.
And I think that's, so we were just about to get to that because I left the daycare center. There was a very wealthy benefactor who sent me for Waldorf training. We sort of discovered Waldorf education and thought this seems like very compatible with the people who are moving out here. But I had to go get training and I didn't have elementary certification. So she said, I'll pay for your tuition to go to the Waldorf Training Institute in Southfield, Michigan, outside of Detroit. And she said, if we don't get a school started, it's just a gift, which was just a miraculous thing. She had children, and I didn't. And when, you know, we went out to see the institute, and they said, well, you're going to have to send someone to get training here. We don't have enough students to just send them out into the country. So I quit my job at the daycare center, and I went to the Waldorf School, the Waldorf Teacher Training Institute in Southfield. And meanwhile, there were parents. I think the Becks were part of that, and Van Dyke's, Peter Rennick, trying to think of some of the founding people.
Arnold Johnson.
Yes, and there were like about seven families that were really, and maybe there were even more, that were interested in starting a school. We had no idea how much it would cost to run a school. How would we pay for it? Everybody was kind of, you know, scratching up a living out here. And but meanwhile, I was able to get not only my Waldorf training, but I also got to go to Mercy College, and I got my elementary courses that I needed to have, teaching reading and teaching math. And so, meanwhile, they started a newsletter. We looked for a building. We found this wonderful building that used to be the
Odd Fellows.
I thought it was the prettiest building in Viroqua, actually. It was a beautiful building, and it's still there on East Decker. And so we wanted to rent a building, nothing for rent, so we had to buy. We wanted to be in the country, nothing in the country, so we ended up in town. But all those things worked out well because we were more visible. We actually owned our property, and we were able to make improvements on the building. We put in a stained glass window made by Larry Calkins. We had, you know, people came just out of the woodwork and said, well, we're painters. We'll tape up all the windows and we'll spray paint the inside. And somebody else came up with a theater curtain that we're going to use as a divider between the classrooms. And someone else came along and said, I'm a principal at a Catholic school and I'd like to help out. And he said, I'll build a little climbing structure and sandbox for you. And, you know, owning our building just drew so many people. We had workshops and built this beautiful picket fence. Everybody cut the pickets and made the fence so that kids wouldn't get out, you know, out into the street and all that. So we opened in 1980. And all those parents who've been meeting, when we finally got down to it that last week, there were three kids children. They were going to send. Oh, dear. Are we going to do this or not? And I said, I just know this area. I just don't think if we don't start now, we're never going to start. We have to start, and people have to see it in operation, and then maybe more will come, which is what happened. But it was like we were teaching ourselves about Waldorf education. Mm-hmm. Then I was teaching the parents about Waldorf. Then we're trying to send out a newsletter. I did workshops on Saturdays. I, you know, was on the radio. I wrote articles, and, you know, it was a lot of outreach trying to get more and more people. And we have also, I mean, I think all to this day, there's an element of the town that really isn't interested in anything alternative. I mean, actually, Viroqua schools were fine. Why would we need to have another school? And I don't know, they're just the people that were moving from elsewhere had traveled, had been, you know, they were more maybe, you know, just more world savvy, and they really were very attracted to Waldorf education.
Well, I think there's a really critical difference, actually, and that is a holistic approach to everything. The food, the farming, mm-hmm. the medicine, the education, all of it mm-hmm. under that banner of Steiner's, they're all coming at the world in a much more holistic way.
Yes.
And in an integrated way, feeling that science and art needed to be together. They made the human being whole. Mm-hmm. And with them all separated into the various individual disciplines, etc., was part of what was contributing to the disenfranchisement of us as college students, mm-hmm. right? I remember that.
Right.
That this isn't making sense. I wanted a different mm-hmm. Way of looking at the world, and I'm not getting it. In fact, it's very different than what I thought the ivory tower would be, a place of reason and, you know, and all of this. So, I mean, I think there's a reason why a lot of Waldorf schools started around 1980 across the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yes, just really an integrated curriculum. Just to give you an idea, I was a double major, art and French. And I pictured an art teacher as, you know, kind of itinerant, runs from class to class. Now it's the time to make spiders with eight legs, and then we'll tape them up on the window. Now it's Valentine's Day, and we'll all, you know, put hearts. And I thought, is that art? Well, that was too bad, but that was my experience of it. And I know a lot of people who've taught art in public school do it much better than that. But I used my art every single day in the classroom. It was an integral part of the children making their books and everything that they did. They painted and they drew. And so we never had art class, I mean, except to learn how to paint, but the paintings were always related to what we were studying. It was, and so that's how all the subjects were. They were just all interconnected. So you didn't have drama class. That was part of your regular mm-hmm. lesson. You didn't have even your physical activity was often related to math or related to stories, and it was all very integrated. And I loved that, and it did really appeal to a lot of the people who moved out here.
Well, because at home they were doing all this stuff too. you know, five things at a time, making a quilt.
You know, spinning wool, you know, and learning all these arts. And I think the parents themselves were hungry for this. I want to learn how to do that.
Right.
They'd come to the workshops and learn how to work with fibers and how to do watercolor painting. And you know, Rudolf Steiner's idea was to make a whole human being that knew how to speak foreign languages, play a musical instrument, be able to act in a play, not just a few talented kids, but everybody, to be able to draw, to make your own shoes, to make your own shirt. I mean, just to know where things came from.
That's it.
Yeah.
To know where things came from.
Know where things came from. So we would, he was very prescient because he was around in the 1920s after World War I and was kind of looking at education as like, maybe we really need to really just look at education. What are we teaching? We're separating kids out and at certain levels, you know, fourth grade, eighth grade, we weed them out. These kids are going to make watches. These kids are going to go work in a mine. And he wanted everybody that graduated from school to have a whole full education in the liberal arts, and no matter what you were going to do. And it was boys and girls together, too, which was kind of, you know, not being done in Austria and Germany and Europe. And so, yeah, it was just, he had a really different idea about, and so he, the technology then, what did we have? Well, I think we had telegraph. We had, what did we have in the 20s? We had airplanes and, you know.
Railways.
We'd had railways. But, you know, he was saying things like, I don't want children to think this is how you wash clothes. You put the clothes in a hole in a box and you shut the door and you push a button and the clothes come out. I want them to dip the clothes into some water and some soap and rub them on a board and then rinse them out and hang them on a line. And then when they discover there is such a thing as a washing machine, isn't it a wonderful thing? Look what it can do. And so the whole idea of the early grades was just give, you know, and in kindergarten, starting in kindergarten, I mean, just learn how to do things from scratch. Learn it the old way. Then when you have the technology, it's something that you're grateful for and you appreciate, but it's not without some, you know, consciousness. Not to make the children conscious, but help them to know. And also to be aware of the seasons, to be, you know, really notice the seasons, notice the way the moon rises and you know, waxes and wanes, and the, you know, the days get longer and then they get shorter, and playing outside enough to even know that and to, you know, recognize that. Mm-hmm. So that was Waldorf education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the healthy integration with nature. I mean, we're part
right.
of it. We
we're
are
part of
part
it.
Of
we're,
it.
We're yeah,
not
we're
so
not
dominant and separate and mm-hmm. harming it. Those issues mm-hmm. we were starting to be aware of those too.
We were, and we were learning from Rudolf Steiner. I mean, mm-hmm. he was way ahead of us, and we, mm-hmm. you know, we were really drawn to that. And so we've all been, you know, people sitting in this room today are people who've been involved in the Waldorf School at some point, Pleasant Ridge.
Well, part of it is the community aspect, too. Mm-hmm. There's an element of community, because while we're interested in educating the individual to be whole, it can only really happen within community in order to be a whole human being, because mm-hmm. that way we mm-hmm. learn how to sense our relationships, be kind, reverent, how to have interest in the mm-hmm. other, and how to build up these things. Otherwise, mm-hmm. we wouldn't go off and start all kinds of things if we didn't have some knowledge about how to work together. How to bring people mm-hmm. together, mm-hmm. what people need to bring together, you know, if they're going to, I mean, it's a lot of hard work that you don't get paid for.
No, the school just took a tremendous amount of commitment, and the parents wanted to be involved. They liked being involved, But it was just, and once you had more than one child in the school, it was like, oh my gosh, we have two plays, and we right. have two concerts, and we have, you know, my third grader and my sixth grader, and it really was very demanding. And I think one of the things that happened in the end, and we're seeing it now, is that children who went to that school have gone out all over the world, and many of them come back to raise their own children in this community. It's really, we didn't know we were doing that, but we were really making a community that the kids could come back to as young adults and make their home here and realize what a precious thing it was to be able to live in a small town and, you know, walk to the library, bike to school, and
to know each other.
And yeah,
because one thing in the cities, I've lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and San Francisco, and a lot of different places. Mm-hmm. And they all have a different tone in terms of how accessible people are on the street, for instance, like whether they say hello, whether they recognize each other, whether you feel like you're an outsider, and even if it's mm-hmm. at the neighborhood store, you're going to be an outsider forever. Or, you know, mm-hmm. anyway, East Coast, West Coast, very different tones. Mm-hmm. Midwest, another whole different tone. Mm-hmm. And so when you're not recognized, you know, that's like a human need. Mm-hmm. And if you live in a place mm-hmm. where you're never recognized, mm-hmm. I don't know. I just think it doesn't feed the human soul the same way as a place where you are known and you're recognized mm-hmm. And sometimes just supported, even just because, you know, you're crossing the street and you need a little help mm-hmm. and somebody jumps up and does that. Anyway,
oh,
I think it's important.
Yes, and now I have a little business in town, mm-hmm. Paper, Scissors, Stone, which is a Waldorf Art and School Supply business. It's mostly online. But, you know, my lawyer was two blocks down, the bank was two blocks down, my tax accountant was a half a mile away. It's just so fun to have all these connections. And now Paper, Scissors, Stone sells some of its items at Utopia. And Utopia is a fiber and yarn shop, but we have some art and school supplies there. And the Utopia buys wool from people who grow their own sheep here. And then she started a woolen mill and dyes and spins and dyes the wool up in Lafarge. There's just all, you know, all these connections. And mm-hmm. the food co-op has drawn so many people. People come through Viroqua on this main highway on their way to La Crosse, and they stop at the food co-op, and they just can't believe that we have such a lovely, you know, grocery store with, you know, organic food and local food. It's just, you know, the town has really grown in many wonderful yeah. ways.
And that started as a buying club, too. That's the thing, is these seeds that you and others were planting and trying to build an economy, right? So that we could mm-hmm. stay. We wanted
so you
to
could stay.
Want
right.
to stay. So we need to make things healthy for everybody, mm-hmm. right?
I hope the Viroqua can kind of be an example to other small towns, which are really mm-hmm. struggling. Many towns around here have lost their grocery store. They don't have a gas station. Most have a library, which is very nice. But restaurants, no place really to go out and eat. There's just convenience stores, you know. What is it? It's kind of like, you know, roll up your sleeves and make where you live work. I think that's what happened in Viroqua.
I think so, too. I really do. And to have enough people so that you really mm-hmm. can share a vision mm-hmm. and then actualize it. So let's take another little station break here. You're listening to the Conversations program on WDRT, Community Radio 91.9. It comes to you from Viroqua, Wisconsin, and this program is going to be a podcast also, archived on the Conversations program. My guest is Philothea Beeson. You would know her from Who's in the Kitchen program. We hear a lot from Philothea as she interviews people, but her life is real interesting because it's, you know, it's what happened here. It's part of what happened here, the leavening that started this community.
Leavening, that's a good term for it, because there are people that really provided leavening. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have any intention to do it. I just came out here to just, you know, build a house and live on the land. And all these other things, you know, these enterprises started up. And we milked goats, and then we founded the Southwest Wisconsin Dairy Goat Association and bought our own, you know, we owned our own cheese is what we did. Because the situation out here was that farmers were just obliged to sell their milk for whatever was being paid in, you know, at the milk board or whatever in Chicago, and you couldn't afford dairy anymore. So the cooperative style is really alive and well out in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And so we have cooperative telephone company, cooperative electric company, so the co-op model was out here. And we have a dairy co-op in Westby Co-op Creamery. And so we started a goat co-op. And so a number of organizations, Organic Valley is still a co-op, and this is a huge national, international organization owned by farmers and producers. And so the co-op model is good because it's another alternative. It's an alternative to just a totally capitalistic model. Mm-hmm. I mean, the people who...
The sole proprietor.
Right.
The sole proprietor business, whether it was farming or whatever it was kind of taking a hit as all of the bigger organizations got started and dominated the marketplace and changed things. Mm-hmm. Like in Kickapoo Pearls, we were talking about that, when... there used to be a little creamery or cheese-making place. Every village had somebody.
I know. They were here when we moved here.
Right. And then they dropped out, or they were bought out by bigger...
And all the cheese started tasting the same. They sent the dairy products to the cities and made it all mainly processed cheese. Mm-hmm. And here you could go to Bud and get this fabulous one kind of cheese that only was made at Bud, or you could go to Brush Hollow. You know, each little crossroads had a cheese factory and their own little, you know, brand.
Their taste.
Yeah, their own taste. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, it was much more like Europe in that way. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, so homogenized is kind of what... It was the direction that that American culture was taking.
Mm-hmm. And the Main Street here, the sole proprietors had to get a little smarter and try to figure out how to coexist with Walmart down the street. Mm-hmm. So to do things that were special and different, and the people couldn't get there, and to have customer relations and those social elements that made people want to support to continue to support the local business while we grew with some of the bigger ones, to have a better balance. I think having that vision was so important.
Well, it was, and this was a huge thing when Walmart came in. Many, many little shops in Viroqua just fell to the wayside. We had two shoe stores, and we had a little craft shop, and we had a jewelry store and a gun store and two pharmacies, and all of those closed. But Walmart hired almost everybody that came out of those little shops. It's not like they, I mean, they did provide jobs there. And I think what we found out, I mean, for a while we were just, you know, thrashing around, like, what are we going to do? And Main Street was pretty dead. And then some of the businesses like Coast to Coast, Penny's, Sears, they closed. We realized that you just have to sell other things. You have to have other kinds of merchandise, other kind of services on Main Street. And now, I mean, Main Street hardly has any. There's nothing boarded up. It's just about 3 blocks long, but it's a very lively little main street with very interesting shops and things that you couldn't buy at Walmart. So Walmart's down at the end of town. People shop at Walmart. They shop at Quillen's. They shop at the co-op, Veroka Food Co-op, and all three are thriving, and people have jobs. And we have the Food Enterprise Center, which was founded to provide people who want to start a new business related to food particularly. They could have a place built to suit them in this huge warehouse that used to belong to National Cash Register. It's up at the north end of town. And now there's, 15 or so businesses in there. Mm-hmm. Kickapoo Coffee, it was Physiology is there, and there was Wisco Pop, and there's a cosmetic business, Lusa, and a meat processing, charcuterie business.
Driftless Provisions.
Yes, Driftless Provisions.
And the Walnut Burger, and there's so many.
The Nami Chips, I think she might still be there. And then those people cooperate, and then there's two cooperatives in there that are owned cooperatively by farmers that are, they're buyers of produce, and then they redistribute the produce. Mm-hmm.
The Fifth Season Cooperative.
Fifth Season. Mm-hmm. So I have to really hand it to Sue Noble, who is another person, just a very modest person, who came in here and had a vision for what we needed to do here to be self-sufficient in our town.
Well, she was a person who was interested in everyone. And so this is another theme that I think is important for vitality in community, is that people have to take a genuine interest in the other. Right, and not always just push their own agenda, but really say, what's needed? What do you think? What can you contribute? How can we work together? She came to the school to introduce herself to me when she was new, and I was in the office, and she said, so what would you like to do? Should I give you a tour? What do you? I just want to know, what can I do for you? I go, really? What do you mean?
Well, have you got an agenda?
I'm an economic development person, and I want to get to know people, and I want to know what I can do here in this place. What will serve you? That was so cool. I mean, no one ever walked in and said that, But that's
that was amazing.
That was her going around and around and around. And so all of the people who were coming, who like Rufus, a lot of people in young farmers, new farmers, wanting to find land or wanting to have production facilities or, the whole idea of having overwintering vegetables was kind of a new one in terms of the facilities that were needed here. Distribution, storage, freezing, all those things were not here. So by when that building came available, then all of those visions of other people kind of filtered right into that.
I hadn't thought about that, but that building made it possible.
It did.
To process foods.
Yes. And it has docks, so they can distribute. Mm-hmm. They have big spaces. Mm-hmm. They can collaborate. All the freezers could be put in there through government grants. They stay with the building, but they support economic development of a certain type. Anyway, we were one of the first in the country to have this kind of collaboration for that kind of building.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, there's so many enterprises that started, and it was reminding me, Mary, you could remember what these were called. I was calling them visioning meetings. Is that what it was called?
Visioning.
And who sponsored those?
Well, I think that Kathy Fairchild got a grant. Maybe it was through VSN. I'm not sure.
Valley Stewardship Network.
Well, yes. Or anyway, there was some funding for the training for some facilitators to go up and down the valley and host these community conversations.
That's what it was. Mm-hmm. Yes. So people got together and just said, what do we need out here? Mm-hmm. And how can we make that happen?
Mm-hmm.
And so many ideas came up early. how could we sell our produce? Mm-hmm. How can we get it to cities? How do we get transportation? Who will buy this? How do we get markets? And out of that grew Organic Valley, just a few people in their kitchen trying to figure out how to do it. And, you know, Organic Valley hires how many people do they employ? Mm-hmm. I mean, they have, you know, they're a national organization now. And it started out with a produce pool, and then it went to dairy, and then it went to meat. And I actually just really interviewed recently George Seaman. You can check my show in the archives. And that I'm doing a farming show, and I really interviewed him about kind of going back to what were the farms like in the 70s when we moved out here. But so that was one idea. And then all these CSAs, the idea of a CSA. Who'd ever heard of that? Community Supported Agriculture. You get somebody to join as a member. They kind of, you know, they put their trust in you that you're going to grow vegetables for 4 or 5 months, and they're going to get a box every week or every other week of produce that's coming out of these gardens. And involving people in the farm, and maybe people come out from Madison and they come help out at the farm once a month. And so the people who are growing the vegetables, flowers, whatever their crop is, know that they have some money to work with and that they're going to have customers. Then the farmers market was another thing, and farmers markets are really growing all over the United States. Several farmers markets have been started here and kind of petered out and then started again. And then, well, wouldn't it be nice to have the school? The Pleasant Ridge School kind of grew out of those conversations, or was growing at the time, and then be nice to have a radio station.
Yeah, so we're now in the 90s again.
Mm-hmm. Is that when the conversations mm-hmm. happened?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because Jim was there, and he put on the board a radio station. Somebody else put a community kitchen. Somebody else, you know, there were a lot of
Have we got a community kitchen now?
Well, down in Soldiers Grove, there's that one.
Gaze Mills.
Or it's Gaze, sorry. Mm-hmm. And then Food Enterprise. Those two things came out of those. The ideas, the interest, the bubbling up. And that's another thing. Without vision, we don't make our communities what mm-hmm. we want. If we don't have positive visions and positive relationships, the creativity can't really come out mm-hmm. and create what we want, mm-hmm. which is another thing I was going to mention, that around the 70s, I'm thinking, or maybe the early 80s, the Utney Reader was created, and so there was a lot of, nationally, a lot of resources put together that brought these strands together.
Mm-hmm. Where did the Utney Reader come out of?
Minneapolis.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And the Coevolution Quarterly also came out of the West Coast after mm-hmm. Whole Earth Access. And Whole Earth Access was this place where people who were homesteading could look at all the tools and all the things they might want to mm-hmm. have or need. But anyway, the idea of cultural creatives was spawned, you know, and I think that's what defines a lot of what happened here, is that we're very interested in creating culture with the arts, the weaving, the metalwork, even owning the newspapers, right? Kate working on a newspaper. There were a lot of people working in newsletters and putting out information and trying to gather people together.
Yes, there's been several periodicals that have mm-hmm. have flourished for several years here that were, you know, self-published.
Mm-hmm. So we're really in the last few minutes of our program, and I'm going to look and see what we're missing.
Well, we certainly did roam all over.
We've roamed all over, but you roamed all over in a lot of different organizations and helped create them and to participate too. And we've talked about how you own Paper, Scissors, Stone. It's a local business that supports that you offer jobs here, and it, you know, gives the our whole Waldorf movement a big resource in getting products that are from America, made in America, to Americans, where in the beginning, in the 80s, everything, all those Waldorf materials were coming from Europe.
Right, and now a lot of our materials are made by individual people, like our crayons and things like that, and our beautiful painting boards, and things are just made locally.
And that was really Annette Park thinking of the same thing.
Yes, she had some vision too.
And then you started, helped to found the Viroqua Plastics Free, and you're going to have a talk about focused on packaging in the restaurants and things. That's next week or
right.
so?
Right, right.
In
We're
the
hoping,
library?
Hoping
What's the
people
date?
Will participate. It's Monday, I think it's May 20th, but it's Monday night.
Okay.
And anybody who's interested in food, I mean, just you don't have to be running a restaurant, but I think there are people that are really interested in the whole plastic problem. Mm-hmm. And how can we help our food suppliers control the amount of plastic that flows in and flows back out?
So I think, in thinking about you and thinking about all these things we've been talking about, and thinking that you're a cook, and you're always asking other people for their recipes. I would say your ingredients for life are education, community building. They go together. They're always central. And they're always in service for other people. And maybe those three words just go together, and they're kind of a recipe for Philothea.
Aw.
Is there anything else
thanks.
That you wanted to...
Well, I just feel like the people that were drawn here were not materialistic. Mm. We know we have to make a living, but so many people here really don't mind scraping by. They don't mind wearing used clothes. They don't mind, you know... It's just not materialistic, just like Sue Noble. I mean, she didn't come here to just, you know, make big money and start a big corporation. She organized people together. Mm-hmm.
There was a book on the bookshelves at school, several copies, called Voluntary Simplicity.
Yeah.
So that was something that people were reading. That was one of the things, along with the organic, with Mother Earth News. So, yeah, there was some driving need for most of us to get out of that rat race and come here and have a different kind of very exciting and busy life, but our own.
Right.
About our own.
Not just theoretical,
but
to really come out and try and live it. Can we do it? Can we live that kind of a life? I think that was just a really cool thing, and that's why Viroqua and all Vernon and Crawford County. I mean, it's spread out. It just adds a leavening to the
area. And so if people want to know more about and deeper into the history, go out to the Kickapoo Valley Reserve and get a copy of Kickapoo Pearls. I think it's republished, and I think they're selling it.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
I'm
so
glad.
Thank you so much for coming, Philothea.
Oh,
it's been really fun.
Thanks for asking me, Mary. This is fun to kind of look back at your life and see where you fit into the community.
Right.
Yeah.
You've been listening to the Conversations program this morning. My name's Mary Christensen. I've interviewed Philothea Beeson. Actually, she was my closest neighbor when I moved here, and that was 2 miles away. I thought, wow, she thinks I'm a neighbor. This is a cool place. And she brought me some berries. But thank you for listening, and see you next month.